Welcome to America's Cannabis Conversation. Heard every Saturday at 4:20 p.m. online at americascannabisconversation.com. Each week, we provide our listeners information, education, and insight into the exploding medical and adult-use cannabis industry. You'll hear from industry experts, elected officials, local growers, detractors, and more. Learn how to build your own cannabis business, how to grow the product, what's legal, and where it's legal. Tune in each week to hear the latest industry news and updates from the American Cannabis Industry Association in Washington, tips on investing in cannabis, personal success stories, and more. It's time to join the conversation. And here's your host, Dan Perkins.
This is Dan Perkins with your American Cannabis Conversation. Quick news. Denver, Colorado. Cannabis giant Curaleaf enters the Colorado market by buying edibles firm. Curaleaf CEO Joe Lusardi said in a statement that the multi-state marijuana operator Curaleaf Holdings said it would expand into Colorado market by buying Blue Kudu, a Denver-based producer of cannabis chocolates and gummies. Financial terms were not disclosed. The acquisition will give the Massachusetts-based Curaleaf a foothold in one of the biggest marijuana markets in the country. Colorado is the second largest cannabis market in the U.S., with sales surpassing $1.7 billion in 2019. When the deal is closed, Curaleaf will operate an 8,400-square-foot infusion kitchen and processing facility in Denver. Blue Kudu was founded in 2011. Augusta, Maine. Maine needs more recreational cannabis testing labs. Maine's recreational marijuana market is facing lab testing bottlenecks as the state moves towards the beginning of retail sales, tentatively set for March, with a proposal to implement its regulations for requiring testing in two phases. About a dozen people attended the public hearings on the staggered testing rollout Monday at the Department of Agriculture, with many voicing concerns that proposed rules would elbow out smaller marijuana growers or further spur the black market in Maine. Maine's legalization law requires recreational cannabis sold in the state to be tested in Maine. Maine's legalization law requires recreational cannabis sold in the state to be tested in the state. But some who are considering opening a testing lab in Maine told regulators that they worry about rapidly shifting regulations, which could leave them holding the bag on investments in the expensive equipment needed to test for everything Maine's adult use law requires. Depending upon what the lab is expected to test for, equipment costs could range from $250,000 to over $1 million. And finally, New York, New York. Consider franchising if you want to quickly grow your cannabis company's footprint. Matthew Kiddey, a New York-based attorney for the firm of Fox Rothschild, believes that marijuana and franchising business models seem like a good fit, especially as a way for new cannabis businesses to make a quick impact through a well-known brand. But cannabis and franchising can be a complex marriage because of the federal regulations that handcuff both sectors. Entrepreneurs shouldn't see this as a major deterrent, however, because franchising is another way to spread the risk, expose the brand, and it makes a lot of sense for certain kinds of brands. This has been your American Cannabis Conversation Quick News. I'm Dan Perkins. Let's see who's on the program today. Ladies and gentlemen, we have an incredible guest, Mr. Rick Lindsay, who's going to talk to us about a breakthrough product that his company and we are offering to the cannabis industry. We have found a way in which to make nationwide banking safe. Important interview. Rejoining us on the conversation, Bruce Litton is going to talk about one of the companies he's working with that creates CBD product for pets. Having lost a pet, he's decided that he wants to make the quality of life in the remaining years of pets as viable as us as human beings. And our final guest, Larry Mishkin, is an attorney out of Chicago, and he's going to talk to us about a very important subject, and that is, how do we travel with cannabis? Can we take it from state to state, and what are the repercussions if we get arrested or detained because we have cannabis? So Larry will help us with that. So let's get on with the conversation. I'm Dan Perkins.
Your new cannabis electronic checking account can offer you PIN secure credit and debit cards for your clients. We can place a cashless ATM at your checkout counter, which reduces the amount of cash on hand. Did you know that we can help you bring legacy cash into your new cannabis electronic checking account? No more paying with cash. Making payments with your electronic check is safe and secure. So if you find yourself up at night worrying about somebody breaking in and stealing your cash, consider a cannabis electronic checking account. To find out if a cannabis electronic checking account is right for you, call 888-420-8884 and ask for Dan Perkins. That's 888-420-8844.
Welcome back to the conversation, and joins us today is a gentleman who I have talked to several times who has solved a major problem. It's probably the biggest problem in the cannabis-related business. His name is Rick Lindsay, and he's here to talk to us about the problem of managing cash in the cannabis industry. So, Rick, welcome to the conversation.
Thank you, Dan. It's great to be here.
Thank you. Talk a little bit, if you would, about the problem. I mentioned to you before we went on the air doing a story about the police department in Denver indicating that 2019 was the highest break-in rate and robbery rate in 3 years in medical marijuana and recreational marijuana dispensaries in the city of Denver. So let's talk about what's going on about cash in this industry, and maybe we should start off with a little reason why it's cash.
Yeah, you know, with the cash, the whole reason the industry's been on cash is we're going, you know, we're ending prohibition of a product for the first time in our lifetime, and in that, we're not ending it federally yet. You know, we're at the state level with everything becoming legal for medical marijuana and then recreational marijuana. So each state has completely different laws when you start looking at how everything's being passed. It's just not one set of laws everybody's adopting state by state, and everything is cohesive between the states. So with that, you still have the federal monetary system that everything mm-hmm. has to follow, and the feds, with the federal government and the federal banking system, they don't recognize cannabis as legal nationwide yet. So each state has its rules, and then FinCEN, Financial Crimes Enforcement, has come up with a checklist that a bank would need to follow in the state where cannabis has been set up as legal in order for a bank to do business. But they've put heavy, heavy restrictions on those banks, which keeps banks from wanting to open their doors to the cannabis industry.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that happens with that is there's still a lot of dirty money in the system, you know, unaccounted for, not taxes haven't been paid, the whole thing. So mm-hmm. the bank's worry is laundering money, right? And we see it on a daily basis with deposits of how things work, and you know, one of our biggest concerns is money coming in the system that appears to be laundered money, and mm-hmm. we have to be responsible for that to FinCEN, the Financial Crimes Enforcement. We have to maintain compliance on every single penny that comes in and out of the banking system. So, you know, FinCEN will allow it, and they allow it based on each state's rules. But if something is not correct and it's not 100% accounted for, you know, not 99.9, 100%, then it flips over to federal crime. So banks are in a position where, as they're looking at this money, they could be caught up in a federal crime wave instantly because they missed something along the way.
Right. And
that's preventing a nice open system for businesses to do business as a legitimate, industry. And it creates all this cash on hand, which, you were talking about. Trying to provide the security to handle hundreds of thousands of dollars of cash on hand is
mm-hmm. or millions.
Extremely expensive. Millions, yeah. And we've run across that a lot.
Sure.
And and, you know, protecting it, having it there, and then that's your entire business's lifeline. You know, these business owners that are doing it legitimately, they've put everything on the line, just like in any other industry when you start a business. You pour it all in. You know, probably a lot of their life savings has went into starting this up and keeping mm-hmm. it going and trying to work their way through the licensing system alone. And then they get their business open and operating, and their, you know, their cultivation, the manufacturing, the packaging, and they're doing all this. It's blood, sweat, and tears went into this. And now they've got to figure out, what do I do with all this cash? It's mm-hmm. hard to pay your bills. You know, if you're renting, one of the big issues like a dispensary would have and a grow operation was, where can they get a building that they're allowed in the city that they're working in? Where can they get a building? Because if a lot of places, if the bank that's holding the note on that building finds out there's a cannabis business in there, well, under their national guidelines, they call the note due on that owner. So a lot of owners don't even want to rent to them. And then the owners have to take cash. And when you walk into a bank with cash on a, you know, if you're renting a large building to somebody, your rent could be $10,000, $15,000, $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 a month. Mm-hmm. Now a business owner has to walk in with cash to their bank and say, well, I have a company, you know, that gives me $40,000 a month in cash. Well, that sends red flags up all over the place. Where's this cash mm-hmm. coming from? What are you doing? Now, your bank account is suspect as the business, as the, you know, real estate property owner, because you're bringing cannabis money into the banking system that's unaccounted for.
It's amazing. I have and we haven't even talked a lot or hardly talked about the physical risk to employees and customers with robberies and break-ins, stealing the cash and the product. And in most cases, the owner can't buy insurance to protect his loss. If he loses the product and he loses the cash, there's not much he can do about it. He has to regroup and start over. So it's really a terrible situation, you know, and you're right. If you have to pay cash and you walk into the bank and you deposit more than $10,000, that requires a suspicious or SAR report that the bank has to file, because they want to know where the source of the $10,000 were. And it's, in addition to that, because you're a cash business, it becomes difficult to pay for products and services, taxes to the state government or the city government, your employees providing benefits. All these things are not available under this all cash business system, because, as you said, some landlords and other organizations won't take cash. I just saw recently, I think it was in Nevada, where they're working on legislation that will now no longer allow tax bills to be paid in cash. So you have this huge problem in an industry that's growing at 35-40% a year, expected to be a 25 billion dollar business in the next 2 to 3 years. So you guys decided you're going to solve a problem, and that's important that you realized you had a problem. And we're talking with Rick Lindsay about his company that has solved the problem for depositors all over the country. So talk about what it is you do.
So what we provide is a legitimate, transparent business checking account solution for the cannabis industry. We provide all the reporting. You know, the compliance is huge. Not only do you have, as you mentioned, you know, the suspicious activity reports, the SARs, but you have a cash transaction report, the CTR. You have an 803 filing that you have to have. You have to have Bank Secrecy Act paperwork that you're following. Mm-hmm. So, and this isn't, you know, on an overall or just a one-off transaction that might, you know, hit a certain dollar amount, which in the cannabis industry, a lot of transactions hit those dollar amounts. But this is on every single transaction, has to be reported properly. You know, we talked about earlier, you know, 100% compliance. So we've created a compliance system that allows for us to work with the banking industry and handle legitimate, you know, commercial checking accounts for the cannabis industry. They're high risk, so there's some limitations to it, but it allows the business owner to get the cash out of their business and into the banking system legitimately. Everybody knows what's going on. So when they want to pay their taxes, they can wire the money to the state. When they pay a vendor, if their vendor has a bank account, they can wire the money to the vendor's bank account. They can pay their utility bills. They can pay their rent. They can get insurance. You know, there's a few insurance companies out there that are starting to take cannabis companies, and a few human resource companies that you and I have been talking with. And they can provide the whole suite of human resources for the business now because the money is banked. And with the money being banked, it's accounted for. Everybody knows the taxes are paid on it. And we can help solve that solution. You know, we're all former business owners in one way or another, and we know what it takes to really legitimately run a business and take care of your people. Because, you know, it's as we see on TV all the time, I don't know if you watch The Profit as much as I do, but, you know, people, processes, and product. And the industry gets caught up because they don't have a way to bank it. And
right.
With that, we've created the compliance system. We live with FinCEN, you know, almost sitting at our desk every day. But at the same time, it allows these businesses to get themselves in a position to now, the investment they've made in their company, the investment they've made in their people, the investment they've made in their products, it allows them to grow that to achieve the vision that they wanted. And that's the whole motivation behind the work that we do. It's not easy. It's not as smooth as a normal, traditional, like opening up a shoe store.
Mm-hmm.
But we get the job done.
Well, let's talk about the types of businesses that would be under this regulation that you can help.
You know, that's a great point. There's a lot of, this extends out, you know, it's the spider web effect. Not only is it cultivation business, manufacturing business, dispensaries to deliver the product, but it's also the ancillary businesses that work with them. If you're a tax accountant and you're working with the cannabis industry and they pay you as a tax accountant, you need a cannabis-compliant bank account, because if you put that in your regular business account, you'll lose your business account over it because you're bringing cannabis money into a regular business account.
Mm-hmm.
The bank doesn't know if it's accounted for. So all the ancillary businesses that work with the cannabis industry also need to have compliant business accounts. So we work with the entire system, the entire supply chain, and the motivation behind that is to create a legitimate industry and be at the forefront to help everybody.
Now, at this point of the program, I would say to you, would have said to you, so Rick, how do we get in touch with you? But that's different this time because we are one of your distribution points. So what people want to do who are in any, all these facets of this business, they need to go to W420RadioNetwork.com and look for the cannabis electronic checking account icon, and we'll start them in the process of qualifying for that bank account and help them take a lot of pressure out of their lives. So, Rick, thank you so much for joining us today and educating our audience about how there is a real solution to deal with cash anywhere in the country.
Well, thank you, Dan, and we really appreciate the work that you're doing to help bring, you know, legitimate financial solutions to the cannabis industry.
You're listening to America's Cannabis Conversation on the W420 Radio Network.
Dan Perkins here for the Cannabis Electronic Checking Account. If you find yourself worried about all the cash you have on hand, if you've heard about a number of dispensaries being robbed and concerned your turn may be coming up, then we have a solution for you and for your cash. The Cannabis Electronic Checking Account is for you to give you and your money more security and peace of mind. If you're running out of places to store your cash, then give me a call, 1-888-420-8884, and ask for Dan Perkins. And let's talk about our solution to make your money safe.
Welcome back to the conversation. And joining us today is a gentleman who's been with us before with an exciting new product for almost anybody in the industry, in any facet of the cannabis industry. He's Rick Lindsay. And he's going to talk to us now about the kinds of services this cannabis electronic checking account can provide. Rick, thank you for joining us today on the conversation.
That's great to be here, Dan.
How will this cannabis electronic checking account help all these people in the cannabis industry?
What it provides is it provides the legitimate financial transactions for the industry to set up the way they need to be set up. It allows them to make deposits and get cash out of their businesses and into the bank. It allows them to pay their taxes. You know, I was with a tax collector in California in a meeting one day, and she was telling us that they dread tax time for cannabis companies because people will come into the tax office. She said, you know, a guy walked in with over $800,000 strapped to his body, and he has to get there with his own security, and then once he's in the building, then they can take over. She said, but she requires two people to take the money off of his body and count it, and one person to supervise the money coming off of his body and being counted, and then they have to recount it once it's already been counted for a verification. She said that one person took up three people for over 9 hours in one day. That was just one business. If the money would have been in the system, he could have wired his $800,000 right to the tax collector's office and been done with it in a five-minute transaction.
I have a friend who owns several dispensaries in Northern California. And this past summer, he had three of them robbed in one weekend. And the third dispensary, they stole the car, crashed through the front door, and stole not only all the product that they could get their hands on, but they literally tied a chain to the safe and used the stolen car to drag the safe out of the dispensary. We talk about the idea of being able to have wire money to the state or whoever you got to pay taxes or pay your bills. But there's a whole other element here with this cash, and that is the personal bodily risk of either being held up or having your store broken into. And if you lose your product and you lose your money, you generally can't get any insurance. So trying to protect your capital, the cash flow coming into the business is very important. And having cash in wall safes and safes in the floor and duffel bags and suitcases and whatever, because it's a cash business, it's a real problem. So you've got not only the liquidity issue, but you've got the safety issue.
Exactly. You know, I remember years and years ago when I started in the electronic payments industry, it was, you know, the word when it was just really getting started, it was cash is dirty and cash is dangerous. That's why the electronic transaction industry grew so much. And it comes down to other things, too. You know, the insurance industry, getting crop insurance for a cultivator. You know, a farmer can insure their crops against losses, but for a cannabis cultivator, the options are limited for them. Now, there are a few places they could get it, but if they don't have a bank account, that insurance company will not take out a policy for them. So, and just insuring a crop or your distribution and your manufacturing, getting equipment. You know, the equipment for a manufacturing facility is very expensive. And to be able to purchase that and pay for it, they're not going to give you the credit that you need, the leasing that you need on that equipment, if you can't pay them with a bank account and show that you're a legitimate business, because the leasing company's not going to take cash. Right.
And the other issue is if you've got people working for you, if you're vertically integrated and you're growing your own crop and processing, you've got personnel, you got people that are working for you that have to get paid, and you're going to pay them in cash, which is going to be a problem. But you've also got, if you've got a lot of cash because you've got a successful business, you're going to have to hire security. This gentleman up north was spending $80,000 a month in security to try and protect the cash and his stores all over Northern California. And obviously it wasn't enough because he got broken into three times, but But there are personnel issues. There's employee issues who are nervous, and then you've got all of the grow houses and everything else. So when you look at it from that standpoint, it's a big problem in many, many different facets of the business. It's hard to attract people if you can't give them workman's compensation or a pension or medical insurance because nobody will take the cash.
And along with that, I've seen recent states trying to pass legislation saying, as a cannabis company, you're going to be required to provide those services for your employees.
Mm-hmm. But if you can't execute the transaction, it's really tough. Let's talk a little bit about the process. The process starts basically with me. I'm the control person for W420. We have a website, W420RadioNetwork.com. You go there, you'll see the Cannabis Electric Checking Account, and you click on it, and you can call me at the 888 number, and we'll talk about starting the process. But first and foremost is the collection of information, because you have to do extensive due diligence on a customer before you can take a prospect, before you can make them a customer. Talk a little bit about the due diligence.
Yeah, so what we require, and they'll go through with the pre-qualification with you, is an entire financial package on every owner of the business that has 25% or more ownership. We need the business financials for 3 years. If they don't have 3 years of business financials, we need personal financials for the last 3 years. We need copies of all the licenses. We need, you know, their lease on their buildings. There's a whole checklist that you'll be able to provide them to prepare in order to do an application.
Mm-hmm.
Once we receive that application, they've been through the pre-qualification process with you, and we receive it. We have a two-part underwriting process. You know, we have to get all the verifications, and some of the states that we work in still require, it's all done manually. They haven't set up electronic verification systems.
Right.
Like a traditional company, right? So we have to do snail mail to verify certain parts of it. We do background checks. We do criminal background checks on the ownership group. We do all the LexisNexis reports. Once we complete the first round of underwriting, then it goes to a second round of risk underwriting that will allow us to get it through FinCEN and register an account. So it's a 4 to sometimes 8 week process. And two different sets of underwriting, a lot of eyes on the paperwork for verifications to make mm-hmm. sure that we know exactly who and what this business is mm-hmm. and everything going on.
Well, when we have the account, when the account finally gets through the underwriting and due diligence process, you say, okay, we're going to give you an account. How does the money get from the dispensary to you?
Great question, because, you know, we talk about security a lot. We don't allow the businesses to walk into any of our institutions that we have. What we do is the business owner will schedule a third-party licensed transport company to transport the cash. We have to maintain 100% chain of custody control and documentation of the money. Mm-hmm. So the business mm-hmm. owner will set up their deposit that they want. They'll notify the bank that they have, you know, $300,000 to deposit. They'll schedule the armored service pickup. Once the money is in the hands of armored service contacts the bank, lets us know. We immediately put a pending transaction in their online portal. They have a 24/7 online portal. They'll see it pending. The money will get taken to the deposit facility. It'd either be a vault facility that we have, a commercial deposit facility that we have, or a Federal Reserve facility. Once it's there, it will go through a two-count process. Again, the chain of custody is documented along the way. The first process is a validation and preliminary count. We make sure there's no counterfeit bills in the deposit. If there are counterfeit bills, they'll be taken out of the deposit and returned to the business owner. Then we do a second verification count, and then they'll see that the money goes live in their portal. It's about a 2 to 3 day process on cash deposits.
Now, I understand that you also have the ability to put a cashless ATM machine in the dispensary so that they have even less cash they have to be concerned about. and their customers can use the cashless ATM machine with a PIN-activated debit or credit card for a transaction.
That's correct. It shows up, you know, it's a cashless ATM system, so it's just as if the customer is going to a local ATM and getting cash out of the machine to bring it in. This performs the transaction right on their countertop. The customer will pay their cash, you know, their foreign ATM fee, $3.50. It gets charged to them, so they, if the bill is, you know, $82, it rounds up to the next $5. So and the system will tell the business owner there's a $3 due back to the customer, but it also bills that customer the $3.50. There's no fee to the dispensary. They get their, they'll get a daily batch deposit into their account that's identified as them per their, you know, per the terminal being used, and the customer's bank account will just reflect that they did an ATM withdrawal.
If I have a customer that walks in today that uses the banking system, uses the cashless ATM, when do I, as the dispensary owner, get the receipt of the credit for the transaction?
The system will batch out in the middle of the night and then the day after. So it's about 48 hours, 24 to 48 hours.
Is it that difficult to get money out? Or are we just going to use, will we use the electronic, and it may, it'll make it a much simpler process when we basically say, hey, I need to wire $10,000 to the state of California for my quarterly tax estimate. I just get on the on a computer terminal, I assume a secure terminal, check into my account, give them the wire instructions, and they wire the money.
It works that way. And then they can also call and talk to a live person who will handle the transaction for them. When we do that, one thing that's unique about high-risk banking is they'll request a transaction. We will file all the reports on that transaction, and then the money will go out.
Okay.
In cannabis banking, they do not get a checkbook. So everything is done electronically through the bank.
So I've got one more question, and then we're obviously out of time, but I've got to ask it anyway. Is this program only for businesses?
Yes.
Only businesses. We've been talking today with Rick Lindsay, who is one of the brains behind this new electronic cannabis checking account system that's going to deal with the cash and help everybody in the cannabis business have a more secure environment. And if you want more information on Rick's product, contact us at W420RadioNetwork.com and look for the cannabis electronic checking account section, and we'll start you in the process. Rick, thank you so much for joining us today, and I know we're going to be talking to you a lot in the near future.
Thank you, Dan. I really appreciate it and appreciate what you're doing for everybody in the industry.
Thank you. So if you missed a portion of this and you're going to want to hear this whole conversation with Rick, go to W420RadioNetwork.com. Look for the archive section and listen to this show and other shows. We'll be right back.
America's newest and fastest growing cannabis-focused radio network is expanding across the country and looking to add to our sales and marketing team. America's Cannabis Conversation offers listeners insight and information on the exploding world of cannabis. It also gives advertisers the opportunity to reach a hyper-targeted audience, literally neighborhood by neighborhood, in markets all across the country. We're looking for a few motivated individuals that want to essentially run their own local business in markets like Boston, Las Vegas, Reno, Orlando, and more. To learn more about this exciting opportunity or to apply, visit americascannabisconversation.com.
Welcome back to the conversation. Joining us today is Bruce Litton, who has been on our program before, and we're going to talk about a subject that we have yet to talk about in the 25 weeks that this program has been on the air, and that is the implication of CBD for pets. Bruce, welcome to the conversation.
Hello. Good to be here.
Thank you. Talk to us about this, I understand, exploding market of bringing CBD to all kinds of pets. Help us understand what's going on.
Well, we start probably with, let's just call it cannabinoids, CBD being probably the first one. But if you look at mammals have endocannabinoid systems, so it's not just those two-legged vertical ones. There's a lot of four-legged horizontal ones. Mm-hmm. And if you think about where does the dog and or cat fit in the structure of the modern human, they rank almost often higher than, say, an aunt or an uncle. Like you're more connected to them. You talk to them more often, even though they don't talk back.
Right.
And
sure.
The effect is that you actually spend more on them than the aunt or uncle, quite a lot. And so what it comes down to is, question is, can these cannabinoids potentially help, say, an elderly dog have a better final year of life? Can they help an anxious dog not destroy your apartment when you click the door shut to go to work, howling and barking and chewing? And so if the question is potentially, and the answer is yes, well, are there any cannabinoids which would trigger an adverse reaction? Because there's certain medications that a human takes and it's no problem. You give them to the dog and you can kill the dog. Then the question further is a Chihuahua the same as a St. Bernard? No. So what dosage do you need per pound of animal? And how do you administer it? And so there's quite a lot of work and thought being done on how do we use these to achieve outcomes with dogs. And the interesting part with dogs is when you run a trial, there is no such thing as a placebo effect, right? The dog doesn't ask, is that a pill I'm on or not? And so you really do actually get a potentially very interesting and specific response, or you don't. And so that segment of the market is underserved, particularly with good science, and is a mega global market. And then you can think about whatever you learn in that model, is there some way to apply that to, I don't know, pigs, cows, beef cattle? Because if you can manage anxiety, well, there are times when those farm animals have anxiety called being shipped to a plant or heat events. And so I'm quite interested in the whole four-legged mammal market and what might be possible but done properly with science, because there's a lot of products on the market. You buy them. They might do something, but for sure whoever sold them to you made money. That is a model I really like if you're not actually selling a durable benefit.
I guess the thing that this is a tough question for me to ask because having lost a pet myself after a long life, and the last year was just brutal for her. But you said, and I'm clearly not trying to put words in your mouth. I'm just trying to qualify. Sometimes our intentions can actually hurt the pet if we give them too much of a product. And
yeah.
That,
or what's the effect of how much THC with CBD? And so, like, I'm sorry about you losing your pet. We had a terrific dog for about 12 years that has now been gone for about, 14 months. And we're still in the discussion whether or not we'll actually be able to ever get another dog.
Right.
But we did try, and I think to some effect, through the best research we could do, use CBD for some moderate benefit for Izzy in that final couple of months. Would I have liked to have had a product that had gone through dog trials and animal trials and actually could be confirmed on a weight basis and an indication? For sure. And so what you don't want to do is take the last year of a dog's life and start running experiments on it. You want those to be done in an orderly way. And I suspect you would have been quite happy to pay a pretty nice amount of money if you knew that it was effective and didn't have possible harm to your dog in that last year. And its mobility might have increased, its appetite might have increased. You know, as old dogs happen, they slow down, they don't sleep as well, get a little more anxious, don't eat as well. You know, all those things end up manifesting and presenting in whether it's chewing, peeing, pooping, moving around all night. If you could actually help them not have that, you would. And then the neat thing is, you know what's going to happen to you? You're going to become an old dog. And that means that when you get to that age and stage, you have a lot of the same indications. And the question is, how do you manage those indications in humans, because
Right. You're
not going to cure being old, but you can hopefully make it pleasant, reasonable, and not have a number of other negative side effects of some of the products that are currently available to animals and humans.
Right. I unfortunately last year lost five relatives in a period of 3 months. Two of them were brothers-in-law. Both of them died of complications of cancer, one with lung cancer, one with prostate cancer. And both of them spent the last year to year and a half of their lives dealing with the pain from urinary tract infections. It was just brutal, the pain they went through, and the antibiotics weren't working. So that was before I learned anything specifically about cannabis. But I do want to ask a question, and I'm not trying to put you on the spot because that's not the type of interview. I just want to get your reaction. I'm a researcher. In addition to being a talk show host and a producer, I'm also a writer and a novelist, and I write commentary. So I do an enormous amount of research. I want to understand as much as I possibly can. And I've looked at, on the internet, specific CBD tincture or cannabis or CBD tincture being sold for pets. I look at the content of the CBD in it and the price, and in a word, Bruce, it's outrageous.
I'm sure.
In some of these places.
Is it even effective? Is the dosage effective?
Well, is there enough of it there to even have any effect?
Yeah. But that's exactly what I'm talking about. Like, what we now see is a premium charge for a claim. The claim isn't validated. The actual ingredients are not particularly costly. What people want to buy, and this kind of goes back to, would you line up to get this product? What people want to buy is stuff that actually is uniformly produced, has an appropriate quantity per the size of your dog, and has a range of specific indications that you give this product versus that product for. And that if they can use things like veterinarian reviewed, veterinarian approved, and that you actually have, you know, this data, most people would not object to the price as much if they were sure that the value was there. And so I think we have a gap to jump, which is quit putting hemp oil, CBD in everything, making claims about it, and then wondering, having half your clients in short order determine, I didn't see a difference, I'm not sure I want to do it anymore.
Right.
That's not good for anyone's business.
I understand. I agree. And I totally subscribe, whether it's pets or humans, we don't have a standard that says what is a dose. We go to a pharmacy, the doctor gives us a prescription for a prescription painkiller, and it says it's X numbers of milligrams. You take it once or two or three times a day with or without food. There are very specific dosing instructions. And even the over-the-counter stuff, there are specific dosing instructions. But there are no dosing instructions on anything that I've seen in a dispensary, regardless of whether it's a brownie or a cookie or a reefer or whatever. There are no dosing instructions.
Yep,
and so if we got deregulation of cannabis or legalization of cannabis, I think would be the better word. Do you think that the FDA would enter into studies to create that dosing requirement? And if so, that's a long way away.
I think companies would do that work, and it would be viable to present to the FDA. And I don't think it will take a long time. So if somebody like GW Pharma required 5 years to get some of these things through the FDA for CBD, I think it's less than 2 years for many others now. And if it was federally regulated, I think the biggest challenge would be how many people bring how much data to the FDA, not that there wouldn't be a great deal of this work done. So it's back to the federal government and the FDA need to be in a situation where they've said what they're going to do, because it's not just CBD, it's all cannabinoids. And if it's states' rights, whatever it is, the FDA then has to be open for business so companies can present to them their trial design, their peer reviews, their APIs, and have it, animal or human, validated against those claims in the dosage. And so I'm optimistic that we know how to do the work. I'm not as optimistic of when we get to start the work.
Yeah, I see a huge pushback in a lot of states that that don't want to do recreational or adult use, or limit to how it can be consumed and where it can be consumed. So it's an evolving situation.
But states' rights would be perfect, because if you don't like it and your state has the rules that say we don't like it, then it doesn't happen there.
Right.
I think the bigger problem is to say federally we're going to have one platform. That would be a problem.
Okay. Well, unfortunately, we're just about out of time. We have been having a wonderful conversation about pets and how CBD products and cannabis products can help them have a better quality of life, especially in their latter years. We've been speaking with Bruce Litton. Bruce, how do people get a hold of you?
So I have a vanity site. It's just brucelinton.com. And there's a place where people can register if they want to be on my newsletters and activities, updates, and media. So it's just brucelinton.com.
Thank you for joining us today.
You're listening to America's Cannabis Conversation on the W420 Radio Network.
Welcome back to the conversation. And we have a really important and very special guest with us today. His name is Larry Mishkin. He's an attorney that is practicing both in the cannabis space and in private law. I heard about him based on an article that I saw in a publication where he talked about being aware of if you're going to travel with your cannabis. So that's what I've been asking to come on and talk to us today. Larry, thank you so much for joining the conversation today.
Dan, thank you so much for having me. It's my pleasure to be here.
Thank you. Let's get into it. Let's talk about what people need to know, and let's split it into two pieces if we could, domestically and internationally. Let's talk about domestic first. So, Larry, what about a person that's under a doctor's care that has a legal prescription for treatment for a serious illness? Is there any exception for that?
The short answer is no. In other words, if you are a patient in Illinois and you are going to travel to Utah to visit your family, and Utah has a very strict no marijuana policy, and you require your medicinal THC in whatever form you take it as part of your daily routine to be able to function and to be pain-free. The bottom line is that, the marijuana cannot cross state lines. And if you manage to get it into Utah and you were stopped by Utah law enforcement and you produced your Illinois patient's card and a note from your doctor, it would not be sufficient to avoid you being arrested if, in fact, law enforcement was interested in arresting you. I say that because there have been instances that we know of where, under those types of circumstances, when somebody has produced a patient card, the law enforcement individual, either because they didn't understand the law or because, let's just say, perhaps they had a humanitarian streak in them, said, well, okay, I see that you're a patient, but you still shouldn't have it. And maybe they confiscate it, maybe they turn the other way. But in that situation, they are not as likely necessarily to arrest someone, but you still could be. So that's a risk you're taking.
I was up in New Jersey visiting my grandsons. And when we went into Newark Airport, didn't see it at Fort Myers, but at Newark Airport, you see policemen with dogs. Are they looking for drugs? If the dog finds marijuana in your possession, you could be arrested.
Okay, good questions, because yes, it's become very popular now when people are waiting in security lines for local police to go walking through the line with their dogs, just casually walk up to each person or walk by each person. And the short answer to the question is, we don't know, and we don't really know because the law enforcement won't answer that question for us. In other words, they're not about to reveal exactly what they're doing. The popular belief, and the one that I tend to adhere to, is that I believe that these dogs are trained to detect explosives, gunpowder, weapons, and things like that, which, of course, is our number one concern in having security. We don't go through security lines at the airport because they're hoping to find marijuana on us. We go through those lines because they want to avoid people taking weapons or anything else like that on an airplane that could harm people. So my feeling is, and the people I've talked to, the feeling tends to be that these dogs are focused on those types of things. And quite frankly, although I'm no dog expert, especially in this regard, so I don't know how many different smells a dog can be trained to pick up. But I don't imagine that they want to do too much that would interfere with their primary purpose, right? In other words, if a dog focuses on a bag because it smells marijuana, and while it's focused on that bag, another bag slips by that does have a gun in it, mm-hmm. then they haven't really been doing their job in terms of what they're looking for. Having said that, I can't say for certain that the dogs don't smell it, and my advice, again, to anyone would be it's a big risk, and, you know, in addition to the possibility of being arrested, let's just say that they pull you out of line because of it, and they don't arrest you, but they still tie you up enough you miss your flight, right? So, in other words, it can prove to be very, very inconvenient. So you do have to be careful, although I have never seen anything that suggests that they are specifically looking for drugs. Similarly, the TSA now has come out and basically said that they are not looking for marijuana, that it is not their job to be looking for marijuana. And if they find it, they're generally not interested in it, and they defer to local law enforcement as to how it should be handled. As a result, we've had certain municipalities and airports, LAX most notably, and now O'Hare, given the introduction of adult use into Illinois, have both generally come out and said that if you're found to be going through security and boarding a plane with marijuana or THC products and it's under an ounce, they're not going to do anything. They're not saying that it's legal for you to do it, and they're certainly not condoning it to the point where if you get stuck on the caught on the other end, you can say, well, hey, they let me fly out with it. I think that it's a policy decision, and what they've decided is it's not worth their time and their effort to be dealing with people at the airport who are flying with two joints or, you know, a couple of pot brownies to help them with their in-flight anxiety. Or as you mentioned earlier, if you're a patient and you just need to have something for wherever you're going. Interestingly, they will tell you. I'm sorry, go ahead, Dan.
No, if you finish, please.
They will tell you that it's illegal what you're doing, and they will tell you that you can be arrested on the other end. And in fact, I've heard that some of them will even volunteer to take it from you, just the same as if you had put it into one of those amnesty boxes, but that they will not intentionally take it away from you unless they are in a municipality where their direction is turned over to the police, and those police are going to act in a law enforcement manner.
We're speaking with Larry Miskin, an attorney of the Hoban Law Group, about transporting cannabis across state lines. You mentioned Los Angeles and Chicago too specifically, but there are hundreds and hundreds of other airports. So what advice would you give to our listeners who decide they're going to take their cannabis with them for whatever reason?
One of the issues that we as lawyers run into in this industry is the question of, are we in fact aiding and abetting criminal conduct because it's illegal on a federal level? And I say that because different states have handled it differently in terms of how their bar associations look at and view attorneys doing this type of work. In Illinois, we're lucky and we've been given quite a bit of leeway, and I think that that's appropriate. If the state legislature says that marijuana is legal, certainly my clients have a right to know what they can and cannot do to make sure that they're in compliance with the statutes.
Mm-hmm.
What we're talking about here, there's two different parts. The first part of the question could be, what can I do so that I don't get caught, which is obviously an area that we don't give advice on because the advice is don't travel with it.
Right.
Now, the second part of the question is, I heard your advice, I did it anyway, and now I'm sitting in a room with local police, and my advice to them is really what the advice that we give from a criminal defense side is, you never say anything. You don't say anything. You don't admit to anything. You don't give them permission to check your baggage. You don't do any of that. They're going to do it anyway. But then later on, they have to be able to justify to a court why they felt they could open my bag and go into it without a search warrant. If I've given them consent, that takes that issue right off the table. So those would be the type of general advice that we would give to any person who gets pulled over. You get pulled over in a car and the police officer sticks his nose in the car and says, I think I smell marijuana. We tell clients the answer is no, they can't search the car. No, Mr. Police Officer, I'm sorry, but you're wrong. They may keep you there. They may go get a dog. They may search your car. But again, the idea is once you've given consent, you've lost the ability to raise certain defenses in a subsequent criminal proceeding if it gets to that point. you know, kind of, I suppose, a non-traditional answer would be that if, in fact, you are a patient and you believe that, you know, you need this in order to maintain your daily health regimen, I would, you know, at that point, if depending on who you're talking to and your own particular sense of the situation, you know, there's nothing wrong with trying to explain to them what happened. In fact, my legal assistant has a sister who unfortunately a few months ago passed away from breast cancer. But before she passed away, she was doing some traveling. She was traveling with her sisters, including my legal assistant, and they were flying home from some state and back to Illinois. And at the state they were leaving, her bag got opened by TSA and her marijuana was right on top. She had been using it before they got to the airport, and she just threw it in the bag, and the TSA guy saw it and said, "Well, you know, you have marijuana here. I have to reach out to the police." And she, you know, looked at them and said, "Look, I'm dying of breast cancer. You know, I've only got a couple of months left to live. This is what I need in order to maintain. And, you know, you can take it from me, but if you do, just know the situation you're putting me in." And the guy looked at her and said, "Good luck. Have a nice day." There are people out there who will understand what you're doing, but there's lots of people who won't understand it and don't want to understand.
Yeah, and that's the thing that I think is you're making a very important point is that there are people who have very strong opinions about the use of cannabis in all levels of our government and in society. And if you're not aware of that, why put yourself in a situation where you could wind up in a room, miss your flight, and who knows what else could happen to you?
Well, that's very true. And I think that what compels people to do this is obviously the fact that we've all discovered along the way that marijuana is not what the government makes it out to be, right? You know, you don't routinely see people, you know, traveling with, contaminated substances or things like that, right? Government says it's bad. We look at it, we see it's bad, and we say it's bad. Now the number of people around the country that are using THC to treat their epilepsy, especially children, is mind-blowing, and the results have been fantastic. But, you know, given the United States, we never would have known about this possibility. We never would have explored it. We never would have experimented with it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that really, when you cut to the core of it, the real problem is that they used marijuana, again, just my opinion, for other purposes. It's been used as a means to exercise certain control over various people of different races and minorities. And so it's been very easy to continue to demonize it. And, you know, people laugh about reefer madness. And my response to that is, well, sure, back in 1930s, you can understand why people would see that movie and really freak out. I said, the problem is that they're showing the movie today and there's people walking out believing it based on what the government is telling them. So right. The government is ruining people's lives. The government is keeping a potentially positive thing from people, and it's all being done to protect the lie, which we've all known for 100 years isn't true anyway.
Well, unfortunately, we're out of time. We've been speaking with Larry Mishkin, who is a member of the HLG group of attorneys specializing in cannabis. Larry, how do people get a hold of you?
Easy to get a hold of me, Dan. A couple of different ways. First of all, they can call me direct here in Chicago. My number is 847-504-1480. I'm always happy to speak to anybody about cannabis matters. It doesn't matter who you are or what your position is in the industry. We're always happy to talk to people. I can be reached through my Hoban email address, which is very simply larry@hoban.law. And I can also be reached through the Hoban Law Office, which is based in Denver. And the Hoban Law page, hoban.law, I would recommend it to anyone, even if you're not necessarily looking for legal counsel right now. It's a great source for all sorts of information on what's happening in cannabis, changes in the law, and all sorts of things. It's a great resource, and you can read up about our firm and all of the attorneys that make up the Hoban Law Group.
Thank you. We've been speaking to Larry Mishkin of the Hoban Law Group. If you missed part of the program, you can go to W420RadioNetwork.com. Thank you for joining us on the conversation today, Larry.
Thank you, Dan, for having me. My pleasure.
Thank you for taking part in America's Cannabis Conversation. To hear this show in its entirety or to hear any of our archive shows, log on to AmericasCannabisConversation.com. and tune in next Saturday at 4:20 p.m. for the next installment of America's Cannabis Conversation.